has not listened to these episodes, please go listen to Seriously Wrong's trilogy of episodes on library socialism.
Spend 6 hours with the boys.
Yes, yes, at least.
It's pretty long.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we're not going to like go through all of that today, but I guess could you maybe briefly describe the idea and how you came up with it and why you're kind of into this library metaphor for this future potential world we could live in?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'll talk a bit first about how we came up with it, because like you can actually kind of hear the primary development of the idea happening in real time in that first episode, because prior to the first recording we did for Library Socialism and Usufruct, we had like tossed the idea out in one or two episodes. Like the words just kind of fell together and we were like, oh yeah, that sounds cool. And it has a cool intuitive meaning to it. And like we used it in a sketch in an episode where there was a society where there were a bunch of like libraries for everything, ice cream library, and a few things like that. So then Sean suggests, let's do an episode on library socialism. We'll talk about a bunch of our ideas through the metaphor of libraries, and just like we like to do these touchstone episodes sometimes where we kind of like bring everything back together and like do a kind of accumulation of what we've been talking about. We're like, let's do it through the idea of a library. And like, we just kind of start recording and we didn't really know where to start. So Sean started talking about his history with the Pirate Party and like online libraries. And I started talking about some of my developmental history, and we just started relating all of these different things to the concept of libraries. And as we were going through it, we just realized there was so much more there than we even thought when we started recording. And it was just this really like powerful conversation where it felt like so many things were falling into place and like, oh, this makes so much sense. This is so great. Mm-hmm. And we just got like really, really excited about it and like wanted to do more episodes after just that one. But yeah, if you listen to that first episode, like the non-sketch parts, the main bones of the episode, that conversation is like basically when we were figuring out what we were talking about.
That's awesome.
The thing that really like got me super jazzed in that recording. And like we'd been sort of tossing around these ideas for a while, and there's a few, like we're already fans of libraries. And we'd already been thinking about a lot of things that ended up sort of being incorporated in it. But the realization that, okay, so like the foundational wisdom of social ecology is it says, okay, we've got an ecological crisis and we've got a social crisis. We've got a crisis of distribution and we've got a crisis of carrying capacity. And the two are connected. The two are more connected than people think. And libraries, out of all things in the universe, out of all human things that we know, tackle both these crises at the same time in a really interesting way. Because when you think about it, we've got a problem of carrying capacity. We're using too many resources. Mm-hmm. And we've got a problem with distribution where the resources aren't going to the right people. And the library premise says, rather than make one book for each person, let's make enough books that everyone who's actually using the books can use the books at that time, but then they can return it and it can go to other people. Mm-hmm. So we're going to produce less books total than producing a book for each person. And so that like logic at the heart of libraries clicked in so strongly with the logic of the social crisis and the ecological crisis are connected, mm-hmm. that I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking about what it meant. And then also that library socialism, like Aaron said, is such an intuitive, beautiful little phrase that can connect to so many things.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, I just want to jump in because like Sean's describing the lending library aspect of like modern libraries and how like that's ecological and like this sharing of property can allow us to produce less and stuff. But then there's also the information storage aspect of libraries. Like the most of the history of libraries isn't modern usufruct lending libraries like we have today. Most of the history of libraries is just like humanity trying as best it can to hold on to what information it can from the past and building this constantly like growing body of knowledge that we can all draw on and like mm-hmm. Utilize in our day-to-day life. And like part of what we've always talked about on the show is like the benefits of technology and the liberatory potential of technology and knowledge and information and understanding history in the past. And libraries are so tied to, like, without libraries, you don't really have written history. You can have oral history, but you don't have written history. And they are both this like cumulative reservoir of human knowledge that keeps building on itself. And also they're this signpost towards what we want to head to in the future, and that they're making that information available to everyone and using that information to create the technological and social infrastructure to make the benefits of that shared common informational heritage that we have available to everyone. So it's exactly what we want to do on a smaller scale. It's taking everything that humanity has produced and giving it back to humanity. And we're saying, let's do a lot more of that. Let's do that on a much bigger scale. Let's do that for everything that we can do that for.
And another connection to like the social ecological sphere is in Bookchin's Post-Scarcity Anarchism, he talks about scarcity and artificial scarcity, and how historically we used to have to endure scarcity. You have a bad season, not enough food has been harvested, so everyone has to make do with less for that season and eat less. But now in the modern day, or in his modern day, which is the 70s, but still true now, we have the capacity to always provide enough for everyone. In fact, more than enough for everyone. So there has to be legal systems in place, like intellectual property or the destruction of grocery food after it hasn't been sold, in order to enforce the scarcity. Like the reality is that we have a type of abundance that's untapped, and the scarcity is enforced. So taking that same idea of like the example of the grocery store throwing away all their unused food, and saying the same for, just to take an extreme example, a yacht. We've got enough yachts for everyone in the world to take yacht rides. Take the yacht out for an old spin. We got enough yachts. Like, we probably don't need to make another yacht for the rest of human history. We can just repair the existing fleet. Like, mm-hmm. So this actually existing abundance of yachts is being artificially held back through institutions of the ideology of private property, but also the legal institutions that protect it. And there's an alternative that we could imagine to say, like, well, if everyone needs boats part of the time, maybe we can distribute these boats like a library would, hence library socialism and its connections to social ecology, something that we're thinking about and developing actively.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is intuitive in that today the idea of the sharing economy has been kind of co-opted by Uber, or just kind of like the gig economy has kind of appropriated that term. But when I was in high school or even starting university, I was really into like environmental blogs and things like that, and there was a ton of people talking about the sharing economy, which was really more akin to what you guys are talking about here, in that instead of creating new things, we use the abundance of things that we already have, but we share them more, right? And we're already seeing kind of the buds of this stuff happening. Like in Toronto, for example, there's already places where you don't have to buy tools, like you just rent the tools and then you bring them back. Or there's bike repair shops popping up where you don't actually, you know, go in and pay someone to do it or whatever. You go in and they show you how to do it for free. And then you fix your bike yourself for free, kind of thing. So now you have that knowledge that you can carry forward and then fix other people's bikes or whatever. I don't know. But we're already kind of seeing the buds of this kind of movement in that direction. So yeah. And of course, it does seem completely intuitive. So yes, I guess just for anyone who doesn't know what library socialism is, it's kind of this idea that in the future things would be kind of run like this. Like we wouldn't be producing as much. We would be sharing more things, and everyone would have access to information for free, of course. And then you have the idea of the irreducible minimum where nobody falls below a certain life standard.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's like a sort of basic socialist idea, although it's not – the phrase irreducible minimum comes from Bookchin. And we became sort of interested in that phrase around – you hear a lot of people say like, oh, you know, socialists – they want everything to be equal, everyone to be equally tall, everyone to be equally strong, everyone to get equal sized portions of food. And it's like, that's not really what we're all about. We're all about making sure people don't fall below a certain level that they need. And then again, we talk about that for a while and then we discover, oh, okay, Bookchin had a phrase for that. Mm-hmm. Great. I guess I'm a social ecologist.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we really love the idea. We love that you're, you know, spending time thinking about this, because I think kind of the more common vision for the future that I tend to hear from leftists is this idea that, you know, yeah, well, I guess we'll have socialism at the state level. Everyone will have a guaranteed job. You'll have housing and whatever. You'll go to work for your 40 hours per week. You'll get your labor vouchers and your rations and whatever. I'm not sure if that would be really necessarily in line with environmental flourishing, but it's kind of like the standard thing people tend to put forward, right? So yeah, we just really love that you're coming forward with something that's like hopeful and exciting and also intuitive. So just wondering why you think it is that I feel like there are a few people who are actually coming up with kind of new or dynamic or kind of emergent ideas for our post-capitalist future, and wondering what your thoughts on that.
I think part of it is that the public exercise of imagination is discouraged from childhood. Mm-hmm. For all of us, like that there's something goofy about it or silly. And I think that it is true, like us having the confidence to say this for the first time and figure it out came at the end of 150 plus episodes of us saying stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And just like sort of going for it. And I think sometimes we did come off sort of like dumb or naive, or like, and it took risking that naivety in order to like, this is how I feel, is like that we were risking naivety, and then eventually we risked naivety in a way where we're like, oh, this is really good, I really like this. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it's the fear of being seen as like dumb or naive and stuff makes people stay away from it. And there's also like, there's the historical debates around like utopianism and materialism. Mm-hmm. and stuff like that, which I think hang over people a lot. Again, sort of people who don't want to look naive, who want to be cool, and like, mm-hmm. It's a riskier territory than just criticizing, I think. Not that we're like brave, I think like we are sort of idiots, like we're not. Actually, I shouldn't speak for Aaron, he's very smart. But like I think there's a risk in that territory, like, mm-hmm. But also I don't want to say like we're not like the lone people who have like broken this territory. There's uh-huh. a lot of people who are doing this now in a new way, mm-hmm. In a way that I hadn't seen when I first got involved in politics. But like the amount of utopia, like social ecology has been committed to utopian thought for decades. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of them, mm-hmm. Until pretty recently. But like you can see like Current Affairs magazine and Jacobin, they're putting stuff out there that's like very sort of utopian, like a year off every 7 years. Mm-hmm. There's an increased appetite for this. And I think we're just sort of figuring out on the left how we want to handle this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think it's true that it is a risky territory. And I think also kind of our social media landscape incentivizes people to be super critical and to jump on one another, to be like, that's ridiculous, we have to stick to this tried and true materialism or whatever. But as you said, we need both, right?
Yeah. Tried.
Yes. So library socialism seems to denote mostly an economic system in a sense, right? It's a system, I guess, of distribution of goods, and one that deals a bit with production or kind of minimizing production. So wondering, are there ways that you think that this could intersect with animal liberation, as we are an animal liberation show? I wanted to ask you that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, if animal liberation has any ethical value in it, which I think it does, then library socialism necessarily has to interact with it. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see library socialism. You can't leave injustices not investigated, at the very least. And with our current like food, so neither Aaron nor myself are vegan or vegetarian, but I need to acknowledge that like, our relationship with animals as a species when it comes to eating food is a dysfunctional one. Mm-hmm. And I would even say that it makes humankind a lot more monstrous than we need to be. Like, we could even keep eating meat, we could even keep eating dairy and find ways to be a lot less monstrous in ways that we definitely aren't doing. And like also part of this too, and a connection here, a natural connection, is between sort of social ecology and library socialism and this stuff, is that we're critical of the idea of property, of the abuse of property, the destruction of property, the idea that you, well, this is my chair so I can destroy it. It's a basic idea of like standard property rights. That idea is part of the justification that's used to mistreat animals. It's like, this animal belongs to me. I'm going to use it for meat. So I have the right to destroy it. I have the right to deprive it of like the ability to move around and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So there are areas here to investigate and elaborate on, and that I would actually really welcome vegan perspectives and like people who are who think a lot about this stuff mm-hmm. in like elaborating on where those commonalities are. And I think just like it has to be, so I've confessed I'm not a vegan, but it has to be part of the picture, and it has to be something that like people who aren't vegans have to be willing to like talk about and be challenged on. Because you just can't deny that the humanity's treatment of animals makes us monstrous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's if you Google social ecology and animal liberation, which I did when I read this question, because I was like, does social ecology intersect with it? What is it? There's an article on like the Institute for Social Ecology that's like, it's pretty bad, actually. Like, he compares animal liberation people to Nazis at one point. There's some good stuff in there too, and like the like his ending point is talking about, again, like human domination over nature and how we need to have mutually beneficial relationships with nature. But there is an element of social ecology that conflicts with some of what I hear in vegan discourse online and stuff, which is like social ecology has it draws a kind of line in the sand at humans and saying that we're very different from the rest of nature because of our like self-reflective capabilities. And just like, I don't think we have anything that animals don't have, but we have a whole lot more of certain things, and it gives us a kind of unique position and a unique responsibility in the world. And like, I think there's a bit of tension there, and that's what this guy who obviously had a chip on his shoulder who wrote this article was getting at.
Peter Studemeyer, who's got some great writings on other things. I just know that he wrote that. And I think part of where that comes from too is in drawing that distinction between you know, human animals and non-human animals intentionally, part of that comes from the way that rhetoric of being animals is used in the process of like othering mm-hmm. or ideas of hierarchy. And that when comparisons between animals and, like, for example, you know, someone who would compare slavery to eating meat, like carnism to slavery.
Or the Holocaust is when you hear.
Yeah. In those cases, I get the sort of like, I'm not sure I want to make those exactly the same. Like, I'm mm-hmm. not sure. Like, so that's part of where I think these arguments come from, in that social ecology is explicitly sort of like a humanist school of thought. And it's been forged in the fires of arguments with anti-humanists, like anti-humanist humanists, I guess, like who point out that the ideology of humanism has been used to exclude humans from the role of human and reduce them to animals. So like all of that weird history, I think, is caught into this. But there's also, I should, in defense of social ecology, there's also a second article
responding to that, yeah.
Responding and criticizing to the first article from a like animal liberation, social ecological perspective. Mm-hmm. What's the name of that article?
It's on The Ecologist. I don't know. If you Google, they both come up. If you Google social ecology, animal liberation, they're like the two articles. Yeah.
Yeah. It's on The Ecologist and it's written by the Symbiosis Research Group, which is an active sort of cell of social ecology aligned activists.
Yeah. I think whatever your perspective is on like eating meat, like I think we should all be able to agree that torturing animals is wrong. And like even if it makes meat way more expensive to make laws that you have to not torture animals, that is like that should be instituted today. Like we all know that's wrong, and like people get aghast at the idea of hearing like someone hurt their dog or their cat or the animals that we choose to offer our empathy towards, but then like we want to look away when you see the factory farming videos, and like that same empathy response that would happen when you see the pain on the faces of like pigs and cows and the animals that we don't usually offer empathy to. It's a really like destructive and like morally degrading system, our like industrial meat production. Mm-hmm. Right now, and like that is what I see as like the most important like fight right now on the like front of animal liberation, is like we need to stop torturing animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will agree with that. But I think there could be a lot of intersections. I know there's a lot of like anarchist writers who talk about, you know, anarchy is, you know, the negation of archy. And there's a lot of anarchist writers that also talk a lot about animal liberation and talk about, you know, speciesism or, you know, human anthropocentrism as another form of hierarchy. F. Co. actually has an amazing book called Aphorism, and she talks about how, you know, this idea of animalization or dehumanization is used to other humans, right? So like Black people, she talks about Indigenous people or whatever, who are animalized and dehumanized, and kind of the lower you go on the human animal scale, the more society deems it all right to strip you of your rights or abuse you or whatnot. And so animals are obviously at the bottom of the scale, but at the top of the scale is like the ideal white, cis, straight, able-bodied man, and kind of the further you get away from that ideal, including non-human beings, the more like people won't have that empathy response, I suppose, for you. I definitely think there could be a lot of intersection. I don't imagine library socialism, like you wouldn't like go and like rent a cow to slaughter or something like that. I'm not sure exactly, but
there was an interesting, and I don't remember the details, but in our Facebook group, someone had posted a really detailed connection between the way that we like produce, I think they were talking more about crops and stuff, but connections between sort of some of the ideas around like library socialism and the idea of not destroying things and passing things on and sort of stuff being connected to like food production and agriculture. And it was really interesting. I just can't remember the wording and details, but these are discussions I think that like should be actively mm-hmm. ongoing mm-hmm. When it comes to both, I mean, like leftist politics broadly, but also in specific like library socialism and mm-hmm. social ecology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So as well as we are settlers on stolen land, can you think of ways in which library socialism could contribute to decolonization?
This is something that I like want to learn more about. Like we haven't done our episode on decolonization yet, on colonialism. We've been talking about it as something we want to do like on the horizon, so I don't have this down in talking about this, and it's also something that I think we want to be talking to First Nations people, Indigenous people about, rather than saying like, oh, this is how library socialism is decolonializing and like this, mm-hmm. like I decolonization is like absolutely essential. And as Sean was saying, for animal liberation, like if something is like moral and essential, like library socialism has to interact with it, and we want it to interact with it. Mm-hmm. But like on like a smaller, more granular level, when you mention colonial relations to the land, it does like bring to mind again the social ecological idea that part of the problem here is that we see the land as something to be dominated and used up for our own purposes. And that I feel like is essential to the colonial mindset, this like going out into the world and conquering it, bringing it under heel for the crown, for like the great British Empire or French Empire, whatever white colonial empire you're bringing the land under heel for.
And justifying it with this faux naturalism of like, oh, it's just like in nature, the crabs go from land to land enslaving people. The crabs plant their flag down. It's just like nature. But what they're actually doing is justifying their own monstrous behavior by finding things in nature that kind of remind them of it, and they're like, that lion's mm-hmm. literally a king. Kings are part of nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I feel like that core aspect of colonial thinking is like specifically argued against, or like is the opposite is put forward by social ecology and like by library socialism. So I think there's some really interesting stuff there to talk about, but I don't have a whole lot to go into on that right now.
Mm-hmm. I think with when thinking about how library socialism should interact with the history of colonialism and in contributing to the future of this, it occurred to me, I was like, it would both be an issue if library socialism was somehow representative of decolonization, but it would also be a problem if library socialism was completely like, oh, that's not our territory at all, like we step out of it. Because there's a responsibility that comes with being a beneficiary of this historical system for like us as individuals. Mm-hmm. It's like we live in unceded territory, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh land in Vancouver. We need to, as utopians, not just as library socialists, but as people who are utopians, be welcoming of utopias that come from different sort of like positionalities or that are rooted in different experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that like the integration of indigenous utopianism into the utopian project is like necessary and useful. From my reading, this stuff is contested, and I don't yet know... that we've cracked the code of exactly everything it's going to take to address these like historical injustices. But I think there is some common ground to be found between the way that we're talking about criticizing property and the way that property has this historical record of, property relations that we're criticizing also historically has been used as a justification to dispossess people. There's a lot of, mm-hmm. common ground to be like felt out here. But the topic makes me more nervous than the average topic because it's important to me and I haven't read as many books on it as I've read on other things, mm-hmm. just to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, well, I'm excited for your upcoming decolonization, podcast. So yeah, we just did one recently on decolonization and, an indigenous comrade and I kind of define decolonization as learning to live in the indigenous nations that we inhabit, and meaning learning to live in reciprocity with our environments and actually honor the treaties, which were sharing treaties initially. Obviously, you're in unceded territory, but yeah, I think that there's a lot of ways that it could intersect. I mean, I think that the ways in which it could help our relations with the land. I mean, I think that it could help us move towards greater reciprocity with the earth without also, I mean, whenever I talk about reciprocity with the earth, everyone always says that I'm a primitivist and whatever, right? But I think this idea of library socialism is something that can help us think about moving towards reciprocity with the land without necessarily canceling all of our technology, et cetera. And I don't know what people imagine when they think about reciprocity, but
Yeah, no, reciprocity with the land is like embedded in social ecology. It's one of like the main things. Like they talk about first nature, which is kind of like the natural world aside from humans. And then there's human society, which is second nature. And then like the dialectical synthesis of the two being third nature, being humans in a reciprocal relationship with the rest of nature and a mutually beneficial relationship that is sustainable and can create a society that will last into the future. Like that's one of the core parts of social ecology, that there's reciprocity there. And even if it sounds a bit like floofy or something to say it that way, like reciprocity with the land, I don't know. I think people have like weird cynical mm-hmm. takes when you say things like that sometimes, but it's actually really important.
And to pick up on what you're saying about technology, I think in order to have like a sustainable large-scale reciprocity with the land, it is a type of technology to know the way to do that, like to pass on even through, like even if it was through an oral tradition, to pass on that information and be aware of like the way that our relationship with the land works, I think is sort of like a proto-technology. But to scale that up to a global cultural thing, I think would have to involve the invention of like new technologies to keep us within the ecological limits. Mm-hmm. So I think we're not against primitivists. We're sort of the opposite, but we agree with them mm-hmm. about not destroying the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So how do you see library socialism intersecting with anti-racist or feminist work as well?
When we did the second episode in the series on the irreducible minimum, I kind of stumbled into a framing for this stuff that I really like, because we were talking about meeting people's needs, and like the irreducible minimum should be that people have their needs met. But like a lot of the time when people think about needs, they start to get like really Scrooge about it, and they're like, oh, they need food and shelter and clothing. And it's like, mm-hmm. if you're talking about need for bare survival, yeah, you're right, we need like a little box, maybe a blanket, a few rags to put on, and some gruel. Like there you have your basic needs in quotes taken care of. But like we all know that that's not a life worth living, and it's actually not a life where you're getting your needs met, because we have needs that aren't just base survival needs. We have needs for like affection and equality and effectiveness in the world and respect and dignity. And like a lot of those needs are the needs that have been systematically denied to women and to racial minorities in like patriarchal white supremacist societies. So like, if we want to create a society where people are getting their needs met, and if we understand that like dignity and equality and compassion are human needs, and that we all need to experience these things from others in the environment in order to be psychologically healthy and to have good, fulfilling lives in society, then the project of meeting people's needs like necessarily has to start with addressing people whose needs are being systematically denied to them. So like, to me, being anti-racist or being a feminist is just part of meeting people's needs and starting where the problem's at.
Yeah, I really like that. I mean, you've talked about abolishing prisons or whatnot, so I assume, you know, already getting rid of the prison industrial complex would be a huge move in anti-racist movement.
Absolutely. And we talked about reparations too in the meeting people's needs episode, just as like a way of like, there's a lot of needs you could think of it. It'll meet a lot of people's base needs, because money can buy food, shelter, clothing, education, all those things. But it also meets a need for like forgiveness and recognition of past wrongs mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought and talked about reparations a lot, but it did come up in that context as like being a way to hit multiple birds with one stone. Just real vegan podcast. bad metaphor. But like to do two things at once and to meet people's needs in both of those ways.
Yeah, bringing your animal killing metaphors into.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wanted to ask a bit about this idea of like transition. If you've given a lot of thought to how do we move forward towards this beautiful vision? Have you thought a lot about kind of this idea of the transition process?
Yes. yeah. So, when it comes to transition from one society to another different type of society that's like really, really different. So if we're assuming that in order to redeem this world, we're going to have to make some really, really deep, radical changes at the root. Well, we've been doing a little bit of a historical review of some like historical revolutions. It's one of the things that we've been studying recently to sort of better understand this, of how we might transition and what the record's like. Still very early on in our studying, and have to admit we didn't start already knowing everything about revolution.
What?
However, something that we figured out, and this is only, it only takes one good revolutionary study to figure this out, is revolutions themselves, even the most revolutionary of revolutions, doesn't happen as a thunderclap. It doesn't happen in a moment where you're walking down the street and then you hear a little trumpet in the distance and people are like, oh, we got a new government now. And then they all go to the town square and kick the old king and then it's done. It's like it's never worked like that. There's never been a revolution that happens like that. Revolutions, even in the most revolutionary of revolutions, which I don't think is the type of revolution we're going to see in the future, but I'll get into that in a second. Even in the most revolutionary of revolutions, it takes like years and years of tension building and planning and failed attempts and all that sort of stuff. And then when the revolution actually happens, there's usually multiple revolutions that happen. There's a revolution, counter-revolution, counter-counter-revolution. Mm-hmm. And that whole process takes decades. And wherever it ends up, fingers crossed, you keep some of the good parts. Even revolution itself doesn't happen as a thunderclap. And I think a lot of people sort of talk about politics that way, like, oh, you can't. And there's this sort of reform versus revolution thing. And it's sort of a critique of social democratic systems under capitalism. I think there's some validity to that critique. But the implicit side of this angle is that there's only two options. There's either these very like sort of tepid reforms, the types of reforms that we associate with literal public liars, politicians who are famous for their enormous lies, on one hand, that you have to go trust these liars, or you have to wait for this magical moment where everything changes. Mm. And that that choice is dumb. It doesn't make sense. That choice isn't wise. That choice is unwise to reduce it to that. I think the process towards revolutionary library socialism, which involves a fundamental challenge to the institution of private property and the way that we view private property, it's a very sort of fundamental challenge, I think, very radical and hard to achieve. Mm-hmm. It takes a few different pieces. And actually, I think there's really only three main pieces that I've identified that will be needed or that actually happen in practice. But there's the narrative realm. There's talking about the issues, having conversations like this, theorizing, theory building, propagandizing, having conversations with people, organizing conversations, moving people to action through a persuasive conversation is also part of that. There's also the sort of prefiguration or the creation of institutions, the creations of organizations that do things that need to be done. And whether that's to amplify the spread of information or to provide for people's basic needs not being met by the system, that's the second pillar. And the third pillar is I hate to use the word entryism. I just find it hard to pin down what I'm talking about in a single word. It's any time that you're using the resources of existing institutions, existing bodies of resources, and recognizing where the resources are, getting a hold of them, and then using them to bring about political change, either through something like you could have a state body take on providing for people in need on an ongoing basis. Like that could be the outcome, one of the revolutionary steps within something. Mm-hmm. Or it could be like liquidating the assets of an organization and then putting that all towards training people to have skills and something or whatever. Like these three things interact in all these sort of interesting ways. So like that's the territory, the landscape that the revolution will take place on, the inevitable glorious revolution towards library socialism, which we're all counting on. Mm-hmm. that's the sort of landscape. And from that landscape, we can pull together some like interesting combinations of like, well, these resources came from here. We use it to build X institution and we spread this idea about it, which helped it grow in membership. But the exact form that the transition takes from this society to the next, if I'm forced to make a prediction, I'll say it's going to be really unpredictable. It's not going to look like anything we've done before, mm-hmm. but it's going to involve this territory. That's my thought on it. And also, I just want to say we can do this sweetie pie. Said this before. We can do this sweetie pie. We can do this without being overly and unnecessarily antagonistic. Not that antagonism isn't going to be part of this process in some cases, but we can do it very straight up and be like, these are our ideas. They are good. I'm going to organize against the bad ideas and just all above board. This is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I think 99% of the time you can pull off quite a bit with being sweetie pie above board and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't need the cloak and dagger stuff. Yeah. Or like the weirdly antagonistic violent stuff.
Totally. Yeah, I totally agree. I completely agree with that as well, that I think the revolution is going to be fairly piecemeal. It's going to be a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. And, you know, the ecological crisis is going to, drive a lot of change very quickly, I think, as well. And yeah, I like thinking about that kind of, three-pronged approach. And also the idea that it takes time and it's not just a thunderclap. Like private property, private property first came into being, I guess, shortly after the Neolithic revolution, where people were moving into towns and living that way. And that was kind of, the dawn of private property was kind of the dawn of also patriarchy and all of this other horrible stuff that has plagued us for centuries. And if you think about how long it's been, and, all of that time we've been chipping away at patriarchy, we haven't really been chipping that much away of private property, but I think that the time that we're in right now is really interesting in that, I don't know, I mean, to have the United States talking more openly about social democracy or like democratic socialism, just the idea that more people kind of in the mainstream can also kind of maybe question this idea of private property, I think it's huge, like given how much time we've been living under the regimes of private property, and as limited as social democracy is, at least it's attempting to, redistribute the wealth, spread the wealth and make sure that people's needs are taken care of. Like, of course, it's not going to solve the contradictions of capitalism, but at least there's a lot of people now who are thinking in that sense that we actually do want to meet people's needs. And the point of an economy is to meet people's needs, not to just to meet the bottom line of the CEOs of Wall Street or whatever. So I'm in full agreement with you. I think also in the West, or just basically like Canada, US, some European countries, the idea of having a thunderclap revolution is pretty unlikely. I feel like we're definitely up against the CIA basically and the military, which are, hard nuts to crack. But I think that putting every foot forward that we can right now is important. And I don't think that we should be poo-pooing anyone's strategy unless it's like they're just overtly being destructive and harming the movement. But like, otherwise, I think that all of this kind of strange division and strange sectarianism that's going on right now, I think is kind of pointless. And I think what were the three pillars again? It was
narrative work, prefiguration, and entry and appropriation.
Right. Yeah, I think the prefiguration piece is really important as well.
I'm really glad you brought up the Neolithic revolution before, because it's something I was thinking about recently, about the way that, I mean, at least the common historical theory goes is that through the Neolithic revolution and the existence of the original existence of surplus, like surplus from farming became this sort of like thing that generated hierarchy, patriarchy, mm-hmm. capitalism, and so on, mm-hmm. As this like very material historical event. It just brings to mind the possibility that, and I'm not saying this to be hopeless, or like deterministic, but it brings forward the possibility that it might take some material structural changes in the world to create the preconditions for a lasting, like, sort of global socialist revolution. And that doesn't mean that we should just wait for that to happen or something. But the possibility is also that we're in that period and it's already underway, and that through mm-hmm. digital technology and replication, the future of, say, like, people talking about 3D printers, and there's just a variety of different technological capacities and possibilities that could create a situation where we have a new material base from which to create a social revolution that has a lasting effect on society. I just wanted to draw that parallel between the potential future revolution and the Neolithic revolution, because I think the big revolution, you know, the revolution at the end of history that solves all the problems, being sarcastic by saying that, but the big step forward that we'd actually really like to see might be connected to a technological material. It might look more like the Neolithic revolution than the French revolution. That's what I'm saying. It might. I don't know.
You're saying if we have an abundance, like an abundance of resources again, I mean, we already do have that. Are you saying the opposite, that if resources become more scarce and, like, you know, the ecology starts to fail, then that will create the conditions for socialism?
Yeah, I was thinking of a sort of new type of abundance. Like, we've already got new types of abundances happening all the time, but there might be, like, maybe say a new plateau where there's all these different types of new abundance that create this condition that helps allow for, and we look back in retrospect and we're like, oh yeah, that revolution happened in part because 10 years before everyone got everything they needed in this specific way.
Yeah, one way I think about this is the conversation that's going on in the United States a bit around Andrew Yang's campaign and the universal basic income stuff. And, like, we already have enough of everything to provide enough for everyone. We have that abundance. But there is another level, like Sean's saying, there's like a hyperabundance potential in automation technology. And as more and more things in the economy that currently exist in capitalism are becoming automated, it is throwing a wrench in the traditional capitalist structure of wage earners and employers, and then the wage earners buy the things that feed the companies that keep everything going. So mm-hmm. if you have all this automation and you have less and less need for wage earners, then you don't have people who have enough money to buy the things. And so the kind of capitalism patch to that, the way that Andrew Yang and other people want to patch capitalism, is saying, let's give everyone a universal basic income. And, like, I think that's a pretty good idea. I think Andrew Yang's version of it isn't great, and there's some good criticisms of it. But, like, that dynamic that's at play, the thing that he's talking about, is an example of material conditions forcing a change on the economic system. And, like, that is happening right now. And, like, we do have a say in how that change happens, each of us, like, no matter how small it is, and it's better when we're together. But, like, yeah, the material conditions are forcing a type of change around this right now. And so there's an opportunity there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You're completely right. And that's only going to get more and more, that contradiction is only going to get more and more acute as we go forward, as well as the ecological contradictions, which are also radicalizing a lot of people. And so, yeah, I agree completely that in a lot of ways, the material conditions will force that change. But also, yes, we have to be there with our utopian dreams for the future so that we can we know which direction we want to walk in when all of this kind of comes to a head.
Yeah. And I don't mean to say that's necessarily going to happen, or, like, yeah, that it's going to go one way or the other. It might go the opposite way. We might have less abundance than we've ever had in our lives. And we look back and we're like, oh, the first half of our lives, we had everything we wanted. And now we live in hell. Now we thought Twitter was hell.
Yeah.
Eco-fascism is here.
Yeah, eco-fascism here. We're like, oh man, I thought those Twitter hot takes were really unbearable, but this catastrophic climate change is far worse. Maybe that's the way history goes, and maybe through that we are able to stitch something together to mount a resistance. I don't know. I'm just I'm floating it as a possibility because I think it's interesting, and I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So the last question I wanted to ask was about patriarchy and kind of toxic masculinity. We've talked a lot about that on our show and talked about how actually capitalism is the logical extension of thousands of years of patriarchal dominant competitive modes of governance. So, and we've also talked about this idea of, you know, capital R revolution as having some fairly masculinist framings of social change. And so we're wondering, what place do you see for conventional framings of masculinity in this kind of new utopian world? And how do we build better masculinities and kind of ensure that we aren't replicating patriarchal modes of thought or governance going forward?
I mean, one thing that I'll say on the capital R revolution masculinity connection, or like toxic masculinity connection, is that when I was in the process of becoming more radicalized towards left-wing points of view, it was really, really noticeable to me that in discussions where I was trying to reason out loud with people, like have a discourse, and particularly in most cases men, around socialism, around the history of revolution, there was this undercurrent where I felt like I was being called effeminate for saying like, obviously violence is the last resort, right? Like, maybe not the last resort, but not the first resort. I mean,
it's
like,
at least plan D. If there's plan A, B, and C first, like,
yeah,
yeah, I mean, plan D, maybe, yeah. But I mean, plan A is like, go for it, like, try to get everyone on board and like, try to, and it, like, there's reasons why people are critical of that sort of stuff. But my experience of it was just like, these guys are implying that I'm woman like because I don't want to kill a bunch of people immediately. And like, so I had that experience of like being faced with that sort of like toxic masculinist revolutionary misogyny directed at me, saying that I had failed manhood and I was like a woman with as a result of not wanting to do what they want to do. And that always stuck with me and left like a really bad taste in my mouth around the idea of revolution. So I think here, like, I agree very deeply that this capital R revolution stuff veers into this sort of garbage.
I really like trying to think through these things in ways that aren't so class-centered. Like the idea that the primary othering is actually patriarchy, I think is a really like beneficial lens of analysis. And I think we can look at these things in a lot of different ways, but I think it hurts our thinking when people really want to insist that like, no, we just have to focus on ending capitalism and then like all these other things will fall into place. And it doesn't seem like that's true. And it doesn't seem like that makes sense historically, because capitalism is probably more recent than patriarchy. Like Bookchin likes to premise the origins of this kind of hierarchy and domination in the domination of the old over the young. And I don't know too much about that idea. I know it's in there and it's a brain tickler. I don't think I agree with it, but it's interesting.
Yeah, he talks about that in The Ecology of Freedom a bit, gerontocracy as a potential origin of hierarchy. But I'm in the same position as you, Aaron, where I'm like, I don't think that's necessarily true, but I like the possibilities it opens up and like thinking about different ways of like what could be sort of the keystone.
Yeah, and it also like places the thing we need to change, not just at, you know, we have to storm the state house and take over the machine and start running it in favor of the proletariat, and then everything else will fall into place like that again. Like the idea that we have to like address patriarchy, racism, homophobia, transphobia, gerontocracy to the extent that that's an issue, but just like these feelings of superiority and domination over one another, this ideology that there are some people who are more human, more deserving, more higher up on the hierarchy than others. I think that takes also a lot of internal work and changing how you think about the world and how you relate to the world. And that's also really, really important. in addition to changing the material conditions and changing property relations, which, like, absolutely 100% on board with, but I just don't think that it will necessarily lead to the end of all domination to do that.
Mm-hmm. And on framings of masculinity and healthy masculinities, it's a territory that, like, my instinct is to want to stuff that's classified as like masculine and feminine. There's some arbitrariness to it. And there's these things that, like, for example, when you think of nourishing in the masculine sense and nourishing in the feminine sense, but there's this underlying in people's performance of gender. So this is sort of an unfinished idea, but in people's ideas of gender, there's this underlying sort of like nourishing thing that fits different frames, different cultural frames of how our gender is supposed to nourish one another. And I think just like, I want to democratize masculinity in a sense. I want to like the good side of masculinity, or like the positive, whatever version of non-toxic masculinity exists, and non-toxic femininity. I want to democratize these things in their cultural validity. I want to be able to take what's liberatory about these ideas and distribute them freely and make them make gender a playground and not a prison, a buffet, all you can eat gender, anything good you want. But the thing about gender roles and stuff in society is that to be human is to nourish. And I think that's the bottom. And I don't mean to say this to brush aside difference or like be like, oh, it's not feminism, it's humanism or something like that. But underlying it all, there's this nourishment, like humans are to nourish. And we gender that in different weird ways, but humans nourish. And I think that's a really wonderful thing. And that's what I think of when I think of healthy masculinity, but also healthy non-masculinity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because nourishing in our patriarchal society, like nourishing in the sense of, you know, emotional, supportive nourishing is coded as feminine. And then everything that's coded as feminine is considered less than or embarrassing or, something that's not to be respected. So, I think kind of democratizing that, or potentially thinking about masculinity in which people feel comfortable. People are made to feel comfortable in society for kind of buffet selecting different things that were at one point coded as feminine and therefore shameful or undesirable. I think that's definitely important.
And a way that nourishing takes a role within masculinity is this idea of like protection, but then also at the same time, like,
and providing.
Providing is sort of nourishing. There's also a protection angle, but then also mothers protect their young, but we're not mm-hmm. like, oh, that mother's so masculine mm-hmm. in providing and protecting her kid. Like there's, mm-hmm. it's the whole, I get, you know, when people are like, this stuff's actually weird. I agree with them. It's all sort of weird.
Yeah. It is very weird. And I like, Aaron, what you were saying about how, if we keep our framing, if we only see the division between people as the division between classes, and we don't see other forms of othering as really, really central, then the approach that we take to fighting this is going to be, okay, well, there's the bad guys. Let's get a bunch of people and go get them. And then we'll create a better society. And people don't think about what they have to do within themselves, right? Like, people don't think about, we can't really build a better world if we're all othering other people. Like, capitalism wouldn't exist without othering and this idea of dominance and things like that. So we have to actually look inside of ourselves and say, like, what is it that makes me other another person? And I get kind of deep with this and say, like, well, it's ego. And so we have to actually, like, all be addressing our egos if we're going to come together and build something better. But then people will be like, oh, that's new agey bullshit and whatnot. But I think it's really important.
Yeah, no, it is. It's just part of psychology that people have egos, and like, our egos protect us from like our emotional damage and our emotional issues. And they like tell us we're great and that we're better than other people. Like, that's what it does. Like, it's a part of people's minds. We know that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I think addressing egos means like you got to do some like emotional archaeology, like Mr. Rogers likes to talk about, get to the roots of these feelings that you have that you might not know exactly how to deal with. Mm-hmm. And then you will start to have a more functional relationship with the world because your ego can calm down a bit. It doesn't need to protect you as much anymore because you are a bit more at peace with yourself and with what's going on inside you.
Yeah. How sick is that, that talking about your feelings isn't cool?
Yeah.
Right. You know? Well, it's a patriarchy thing. It's coded as feminine and it's like frivolous.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, it just goes to show yet again, coolness is on the wrong side of history.
100%.
The revolution will not be cool.
It will be not cool at all. It'll be so lame. But yeah, no, and I think that's a really great way to understand why a lot of these, capital R revolution, like revenge fantasy, like violent moment of destruction of the other fantasy, as people's first resort, or as what people want, not even like, oh, this is a resort. This is like, I actually want this. I